In the fourth parak of Avos, and again, there's different versions of which Mishnah Tess, Yud Yud Afid Beis, Rabbi Shmuel Beno Omer, Rabbi Shmuel, the son of Rabbi Yossi, would say, Rabbi Shmuel Yossi Omer, HaChoseich Atzmu Min Hadin, someone who holds himself back from judgment. Parak Menu Eva V'Gazel Shua Shav, takes off his shoulders quarrels and stealing and false swearing, v'hagaslibu b'hara, and the opposite, the person who is very comfortable with deciding judgments, shote rosh v'gasuach, is foolish, wicked, and arrogant. The next Mishnah also refers to judging. Hu haya omer, he would say, al tehi don yechidi, don't judge by yourself. She'ein don yechidi ele echad, only one judges alone, referring to the Ribbono Shel Olam. V'al tomar kablu daiti, do not say, accept my position, she'ein rasha en v'lo ata. You don't have the right to say that. So the statements of Rishmo Abiyasi are addressing dayonim, judges, and Klai Yisrael. And Abin Yonah explains that even though it is a mitzvah in the Torah of judging, shoftim v'shoftim tielecha, you're supposed to have a court system, you're supposed to have judges, tzedek tzedek tirdof, you're supposed to pursue justice. It's a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah ladunas hadin. It's a mitzvah to have dayanim. It's a mitzvah to have beis din. So Ben Yonah says, that's when there's no one else to do it. You have to set up a beis din, you have to have dayanim. But if a person can refrain from participating because there are others who are involved in this, it's much better. And it keeps you out of machlekes, because when people come out of beis din, they're very often angry at the dayanim, and it keeps you away from stealing, because sometimes you find someone obligated to pay and really didn't have to pay, and you stay away from false swearing, because sometimes you make them swear and they're going to swear falsely. Conversely, the gasliba bahara, the person is very comfortable to sit in judgment, so he's going to bring upon himself all these issues we just mentioned, and it's an indication that it's silly. He's a shaita, he's foolish. He's not a chacham be'enov. He's not wise. He doesn't see the ramifications of his actions. And chacham be'enov tikva l'ksil menu. The pasuk says in Mishlei, the person who thinks he knows everything, there's more hope for the fool, because the person who thinks he's right, you can't convince him otherwise. The person who doesn't know, so he's willing to listen sometimes. And the basic theme of the Mishnah is that a person has to think twice before engaging in the process of judging and being done, and a person should be very hesitant to do so. Now, in the bigger scheme of things, you know, there's a balance. Obviously, like Ben Yonah says, you have to have dayanim, you have to have beis din. And hopefully when people are involved in beis din, they understand the reason why we go to beis din is because we want to resolve whatever issue occurred according to the Torah and the way the Ribbono Shel Olam set it up. The pasuk says that Eilam Mishpatim Shetasim Lefeichem, these are the laws that Hashem gives to Klai Yisrael. And Rashi points out that it's an isser to go to non-Jewish court to resolve issues. If there's a dispute between two people, the way to resolve it is in beis din, not in a civil court. Even if the civil court may rule exactly as the beis din, you still go to beis din. Why is that? Because beis din will judge according to the Ribbono Shel Olam's Torah. The Ribbono Shel Olam gave us the Torah, and the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us the rules, and it discusses segments of the Torah. Talk about disagreements between people, between damages and things that happen, things that go wrong, liability, renters, whatever issues come up, it's all discussed in the Torah. And by going to beis din, we seek out what the Torah has to say, what the Ribbono Shel Olam would want in this case. A civil court system is a man-made system. It's man-made. A group of people get together, they determine what they think is important for society to survive, people to live together. You have to have rules, you have to have regulations, you have to have laws, and they make it up. You make a constitution, and you make laws, and you have a legislature, and they legislate laws, and you have checks and balances, whatever system it is. But this is all man-made. It's all man-made. It's all in the way that they feel society can best function. But that's nothing to do with the Ribbono Shel Olam, nothing to do with the Torah. So even if they would have the exact same conclusion or result, it's an aver to go to the civil court, because the civil court is not telling you what the Torah wants, not telling you what the Ribono Shel Olam wants. It's telling you what we think makes sense for society to survive. It happens to be the Torah says the same thing, but if you're not doing it because the Torah says, that means it's almost like it's a Chil Hashem Hashem. It's a Chil Hashem to ignore the ability to resolve something in a Beis Din and resolve it in court. The hesitancy that people have to go to Beis Din is they feel, what power does the Beis Din have to enforce their decisions? Which is a legitimate concern on occasion. Sometimes Beis Din is limited in what they can do to force someone to comply. With a court system and a civil system, if a person doesn't comply with the court, they're held in contempt of court, they could end up in jail. They have the power to garner wages, they have the power to take property, they could do all kinds of things. So there's something backing up the decisions in a civil court. In a religious court, in a Beis Din, what do we have to back it up? There were times over the ages when governments would allow Beis Din the right to punish and to do things, but today that doesn't exist. And the only thing we have is called social pressure. We could say, if this person doesn't listen to Beis Din, so they shouldn't get an aliyah in shul, we won't let them down for the amid. Once upon a time, the cemeteries were controlled, they won't let the person get buried in the cemetery if they won't listen to the Beis Din. So yeah, it's these kind of social pressures within the community to force someone to comply with the Beis Din's decision. But it is weak. One of the things that Beis Din does today to deal with this is to have the participants in a litigation sign a document of binding arbitration, which means the civil court system does allow for the ability of two people who have a disagreement to resolve their issues outside of court with an arbitrator. An arbitrator is basically someone who's trained to help them come to a conclusion to their issues without going to trial, without going to court. And there's binding arbitration and non-binding arbitration. Binding means you sign and you have to listen to what he says. And if you listen to what he says, the courts will enforce it. Non-binding is, he's giving you an etzah, and if you like what he says, you listen. If you don't like, you don't listen. So many Bate Din will insist that the participants in the Torah sign a document of binding arbitration, because they don't want to waste their time. If they come to Beis Din, you sign this document, and then if you're not going to listen to what they say, they will submit it to the court system, and the courts will enforce it. So there is some degree of, you know, power when you have a binding arbitration scenario. Ultimately, the biggest problem that I see with the Beis Din system is that people generally go to Beis Din because they want to win, and not so much that they're looking to find out what Hashem wants me to do in this situation. If someone wants to know what the Ribono Shel Olam wants to be done in the situation, they're not going to be upset if they have to pay. They're not going to be upset if they don't get paid, because this is what the Ribono Shel Olam wants. I'm fine with that. As long as that, I just don't know what the Ribono Shel Olam wants. If I know, then I'm happy to do it. Most people aren't that way. Most people want to get what they want to get. Either they want to get money, or they want whatever, whatever the case may be, they would not have to pay. Whatever scenario happened. Over the years, I will not engage in the Beis Din process. There are other rabbanim involved who take care of that. Twice, I received a call over the years. One case, I remember two women had an issue where basically one lady was in a driveway backing out, and I guess she went to the car, looked in the end drive, there's no one that got in the car, and put the car in reverse, started backing out. While she was doing that, a second car pulled up at the bottom of the driveway to let someone out of the car. And I guess they noticed, or the one in the pastor noticed, the car was backing up, did not get out of the car, and the car backing up went smash right into the door of the car there. And like I said, Baruch Hashem, no one was hurt, the pastor stayed in the car. But now you have this bump in the car at the bottom of the driveway, and they didn't know what to do, who was responsible, and they didn't want to go to court, they wanted to deal with outside of court. So they called me up. Would I listen to the cases? I said, you know, if your goal is you want to know what the halacha is, you'll come to my office, we'll talk about it. But if you know, each side wants to win the case. As we got, I'm not going to deal with it. So they both committed to listen to whatever I had to say, and each one conveyed their position of why they felt that they were right. You know, basically, it's almost obvious the one driving the car was responsible, but they felt, what right did that person have to pull up at the bottom of the driveway? You can't pull up at the bottom of the driveway. What that means, but basically, you know, if the person is willing to accept whatever the Rav says, and they don't need Beis Din. I told him, this is not Beis Din. Beis Din is Shvita Yonim. This is not Beis Din. You're coming to talk. I'm going to tell you what I think the halacha is, and that's it. And I didn't make them sign because it wasn't a trial. It wasn't a Beis Din. It wasn't binding, not binding arbitration. I said, I'll talk to you and tell you what I think. But most of them, it's not what happens. Most of them, people aren't interested just like that to know what's going on, what the halacha should be. It gets much more contentious. So the Mishnah is saying that a person who's involved in Beis Din, it's a big mitzvah to be involved in Beis Din, it's a Kiddush Hashem to be involved in Beis Din, but you have to be aware, sometimes people don't go into it with the best attitude, and it gets contentious. And then he went on to say, he said, Al tidan yechidi, don't judge by yourself. And when you think about it, the idea of judging by yourself, in my mind, indicates a certain degree of arrogance that, you know, Rabbi Yehon himself says, Al tidan yechidi is the same idea of chesich atzmenit. We just finished saying you should hold yourself back from judging, even if you're an expert. Certainly, you don't judge by yourself. You don't judge by yourself. Ain't don yechidi ela kadosh baruch hu. The Baruch Hu judges by himself. You don't judge by yourself. And don't say, accept my opinion. Take my word for it. Take my opinion. You don't have the right to do that. The bottom line is, all of these are indications of arrogance. The idea that, take my position. I can judge by myself. The gasliba b'hara, the person who's very comfortable, yeah, I have no problem judging. Arrogance is inconsistent or incompatible with Torah. Torah doesn't go together with gaiva. The two don't go together. In order for a person to fully understand Torah and to grasp Torah and to be connected to Torah, there has to be anava, there has to be humility. And that's how I look at these Mishnayos here, the concept of it essentially. You know, the facts of it are, you know, don't rush into din and try to avoid it if possible and don't judge yourself. But I think there's an underlying theme here that a person has to be humble. A person has to be willing to accept that he may not know and he may not be aware and so on. One of the things that Chamavad Yosef brings when he discusses this Mishnah of Al Tidan Echidi, Shein Nichdan Echid Al Echad, that he says there's a concern that a dayan should never be suspect of taking bribes. You know, the Torah says that it's forbidden to take any form of bribery, and if a person judges by himself, perhaps there's more room to be suspect that maybe he's being bribed. If there's a group of dayanim, so you're not going to say all three dayanim were bribed. If there's only one, you never know. So he brings a maisa. This story is quoted by the Ben Ish Chai in the Sefer Ben Yoyada, and it's also referenced in the Chidah. There was a dayan in Mitzrayim who lived around the period of the Beis Yosef. This goes back over 500 years. His name was Rabbi Chaim Kafusi Balhanes. Now, we think of Baal HaNes as Rav Meir Baal HaNes, because the Nes in the Gemara that happened to Rav Meir. There was a guy in Rav Chaim Kafusi who also had a miracle. Near the end of his life, Rav Chaim Kafusi in his later years became blind. And people in the community began to spread rumors that the reason he went blind is because he took bribes. Because the Pasuk says, Hashoichid Ya'aver Enei Chachamim. Bribery blinds the eyes of the Chacham. So we always understand to be a figure of speech. The person takes a bribe, he can't see straight. But he became physically blind, and people were saying, oh, why did this happen to him? Must be when he was a dayan all the years, he was taking bribes. So when he heard about this, he got up, I don't know what occasion, Shabbos Yontif, and he said, I heard that there are people who are saying that I took bribes. I am testifying in front of heaven and earth that I am clean and pure of bribery. If it's true what they say about me, then my blindness should endure. But if it's not true, and I've always been careful not to take bribes, the Ibn Hashim should give me my vision back. It's an interesting kind of tefillah. If he wouldn't get his vision back, I don't know if it would have proved one way or the other, but he said, if I don't get my vision back, if I deserve to be blind because of Shaykhad, I should stay blind. But you think it is, and if I'm free from Shaykhad, my blindness should be healed. So it's right, his tefillah was accepted, and he was able to see again. And the Chidah wrote, he brings this Maisa, and he says, I saw this Goyin's signature on a document when he was blind. He says, you practically could not make out the letters. You couldn't make out the letters. It was like a scribble. And then after the Maisa, after this episode, I saw his signature on a document, and it was clear and legible, and the writing on it was, the way he signed it is, Hashem Nisi Chaim Kafusi. His name is Chaim Kafusi. So again, Hashem made my miracle, Chaim Kafusi. And subsequent to his death, whenever there was a trial in Mitzrayim where he had lived, if they had to swear in the case to ascertain the facts, they would swear by his kever. Whoever swore falsely was punished. Like his kever became the place to go to establish emes in trial. So, a person shouldn't put himself in a position where he may become susceptible to being accused of bribery. And a person should never insist that his position is the accurate one, because you never know. You may not be correct in your assessment. Which again is the whole concept of person should be arrogant and think that he knows everything and that he doesn't have to hear from other people. If other people disagree, maybe they're right. The next Mishnah continues, Rabbi Yonasan Omer kol makayim es haTorah me'oni sofo lekayim me'osher. If a person keeps the Torah when he's poor, he'll be able to fulfill it when he's wealthy. Kol mevatlas haTorah me'osher, and one who ignores the Torah when he's wealthy, sofo levatlas me'oni, in the end, he will not be able to learn Torah because of poverty. If his wealth is keeping him from learning Torah, eventually his poverty will keep him from learning Torah. And the very next Mishnah, Rav Meir Omer, have your mat be'esek v'asek b'Torah. You should minimize your business dealings to spend more time learning Torah. V'avi shval ruach b'fnei kol adam, and be humble before all men. V'im bitalta b'nei Torah yeshecha b'tim habi k'negdecha. If you ignore the Torah and find other things to do, there's a lot that will keep you busy. If you toil in Torah, you'll get plenty of sachar. So the first two Mishnayos we've done discuss the importance, my understanding of this, approaching Torah with a sense of humility. And then the next two are discussing a person's responsibility to engage in Torah study whenever possible and not to allow financial considerations or economic considerations or business considerations to interfere with his set learning that he's supposed to have. Rabbi Yonah writes, if a person keeps the Torah from when he's poor, and he says that means he crunches his time, that even though he could be at work longer and perhaps earn more money, he takes off from that time in order to learn Torah and do mitzvahs. So, and maybe difficult, in the end, he'll have enough parnasa, and maybe he'll have wealth that he could add more time to his learning and doing mitzvahs, and he won't have to work as hard as he did until now to support himself. And again, if a person is very involved in his business, it could be a cause of bittul Torah. And if that's what happens, then in the end, he won't be learning Torah no matter what his financial situation is. And the next Mishnah goes on to say, a person should try to make Torah his ikar avodah. It doesn't necessarily mean hour-wise, but it just means the importance and significant. You know, people have come to me often, I can take some kind of night work for a few hours, but it would interfere with my chavusa or the seder or learning. they have a job during the day, should they take on this additional work or overtime work? You know, if it's not crucial, it's really something, it may be life easier, so you should think twice about giving up your learning time for extra income if you're getting by without it. And then again, a person should be humble before all people, because this is also, like we said before, of Torah, that you're only going to succeed in Torah if you don't have a guy with a weight. Rabbi Yoni writes it, Kishatatliach b'Torah she'amal hamitis lo tiskaeh. When you succeed in Torah, which is the true maila, it's the true level that you've achieved, you shouldn't be arrogant in the process. So this is, you know, very significant for anyone who wants to succeed in Torah, that he should make a point of not letting gaiva get involved. So the theme of these two Mishnayos is essentially that despite a person's financial situation, he should do whatever he can to learn. And we all know the story of Hillel. The Gemara says that Hillel is mechayev da'aniyim, that a poor person who goes to Shemayim after 120 years, and they're going to ask him in Shemayim, why didn't you learn Torah? And he's going to say, I was too busy trying to make panosah because I had no money, I was very poor. That will be an inadequate answer. In Shemayim, that will not go. Why won't it go? Because of Hillel. Hillel earned his money by cutting wood and selling it. This before he was Rosh Yeshiva. Once he was Rosh Yeshiva, he didn't have to cut wood. But before he was Rosh Yeshiva, he would chop wood and he would sell it. And from the money he had, he would divide half for his family expense and half to cover the cost of the Beis Medrash expenses. And he would go learn. And one time, he didn't sell his wood and he had no money. So he went on the roof to the skylight and it snowed. You know the whole story. So Hillel was Maisa Nefesh to learn Torah, even though he didn't have a lot of money. So we have a kind of Torah. I mean, if a person learns Torah when they don't have, the Baruch Shem will provide for them when they do. Now I'm sure there are many, many stories that we have in our books and in our Svarim that were taught about more contemporary people that were Maisa Nefesh to learn Torah even though they didn't have. We have our, you know, the great Rosh Yeshivas of the past generation, and we have books about them and stories and so on. So Chaim Avad Yosef brings from the Sephardic world their stories, stories that we'll never hear, but I'm sure there'll be the parallel, you know, in our world. So I just, it caught, you know, it's to me interesting that they have the same series of different stories, different people, different places, to drive home the same concept, the same Musa. So he brings on the mission of Kol Mekayimus the Torah Me'oini. If a person keeps the Torah and learns the Torah when they're poor, they'll eventually be able to learn the Torah with wealth. So he says there was a man whose name was Yaakov Chadida. Yaakov Chadida lived in Tunisia. And he was an Am Haaretz. He was not knowledgeable in Torah. He was an Erlich Yid, but didn't know Torah. He was very poor. His job was to clean out the gutters, to clean the streets. It was a very low-level job. You know, sanitation, but it wasn't just plain garbage. The garbage he had was, you know, they didn't have cars. It was animals that schlepped the carts, and he had to clean the streets, a street cleaner. He had a son, Naftali, who would help him, 10 years old. Also, never learned Torah, like his father. And one day, Yaakov Chadida, the street cleaner, is going through the street with his 10-year-old son, and he has in his hand his bucket full of disgusting stuff that he swept out of the street, and he tripped. He tripped on a stone, and he fell down. And the bucket spilled over, and just at that time, there was a great Rav of the city, Rav Yitzchak Al-Chayik, who was passing by, and some of the garbage from this bucket landed on the Rav's clothing. Of course, Yaakov Chadid, the street cleaner, was covered also with garbage. He fell in it. But it was a terrible ruckus when the Rav's clothing became soiled. And everyone started to scream, quick, bring clean water, bring shmatas, let's clean the Rav. And they're pouring it on the Rav and the cleaning off his clothes. And at the same time, they're basically cursing out the street cleaner that how can you be so clumsy and how can you be so careful and you got the Rav dirty. and the 10-year-old child is standing there watching this whole thing, and he just starts to cry. And he helps his father to his feet, and he takes a shmata, and he starts to try to help clean his father up, and together they go home, and he tells his mother the whole story. She starts to cry. Terrible story, terrible embarrassment, the bizyonis and the rav, and the whole city saw, and it was very sad. So the 10-year-old boy Naftali says to his mother, why is it that everyone was so nervous about the rav to take care of his clothing, and no one took care of Abba? I mean, he's also fell, and didn't they feel he was embarrassed, and his clothes were all dirty too? So the mother said, no, you don't understand. The rav is a ish kadosh, he's a holy man. Everyone has to honor the rav. He spends his days learning Torah day and night. And everyone has to be careful with the covet of the rav, but they don't have to be so careful with your father. So this 10-year-old boy said, so how do we learn Torah? He never learned, never went to cheder. So he said, well, you can learn Torah in Tunisia. The problem is you have to pay tuition. And we can't afford tuition. There's a big city in Bavel, now this is, they're in Tunisia, this is North Africa, in Bavel, in Iraq, there they have a school system where they teach, there's no fees, and the malamdim get paid by the community. It's a community thing, and they don't have to pay tuition. So he decided at 10 years old, he's going to go to Bavel to learn Torah. So the following day, he's with his father, back to the streets, and a caravan of camels and donkeys is going by, and the 10-year-old Naftali says, where are you going? They said, we're going to Tripoli. So he asked the leader of the caravan, would you want someone to help you guide your animals, and I'll come and then I'll work and take me with you. So he said, if your father agrees, I'll agree. He went to his father. It's very interesting. Don't say he asked his mother, but he asked his father, can he go to Tripoli? And he said, yeah, you can go to Tripoli with them. And basically, he's told us, I'm going to Bavel. I'm going to make my way to Iraq. Somehow, some way, I'm getting from Tunisia to Iraq. So he made his way to Tripoli, and from Tripoli to the next city, to the next, until he found his way all the way to Iraq. Doesn't say how long it took him to get there. He arrives in Bavel on a Thursday afternoon, and the caravan that went to Bavel, the leader of the caravan, one of the people of the caravan, wanted to deliver a gift to a wealthy, significant Yid in Bavel, Ovadia ben Eli. And he asked this child, Naftali, to bring the gift to the house of this wealthy man, Ovadia. So he goes to the house of this Yid Ovadia, who is a wealthy, important man. And he puts down the basket, and he's ready to leave. And the Balabai says to him, don't leave. Eat something, drink something. You came a long way. So while he's sitting with him eating, and he says to the boy, he says, what are you doing here? What's the purpose of your coming to Bavel? So he says, I came from Tunisia, and I want to learn Torah. So Balabai says to him, I understand Tunisia, they don't teach Torah in Tunisia. So he said, they do, but they don't do it for free. And I was told that, he told the whole story, what brought him to Bavel. So this Balabayis Ovadia had compassion on this boy, and he said, you know what, you stay in my house. I'm going to hire a Malamed on Sunday morning to teach you. He knew nothing. He knew nothing, this 10-year-old. We'll start Sunday morning, but you have to take your learning seriously. So the boy says, why wait till Sunday? Well, why not start tonight? So he liked that answer. You're right. Wash up, change your clothes, we'll start tonight. He had his son start teaching them Aleph Beis. Pasha, learn, teach them Aleph Beis. Teach the Aleph Beis, teach the Nakudas. By Sunday morning, he went to the Malamed, and this Naftali put his effort into his learning, and he stayed in Bavel, and he learned day and night, and became a tremendous Talmid Chacham. Sometime later, the king died in Bavel, the non-Jewish king, and his two sons were fighting over who takes over the throne, and the army was split into two groups, and there's going to be a civil war, and the people were terrified, and they fled the city, and they went into caves to hide until this was settled. So this boy Naftali also ran, and in a cave that he was hiding, he found a container full of precious stones and gems. So when the battle, the civil war stopped, and the kingdom was established, he went back to the house of this Ovadia, who watched out for him all the years. He said, this is what I found in the cave. So the Baal Bayis said, you keep learning, I will invest the money for you, and it'll be your money, and you'll have something to build a house with and get married with, and so on. So because of the money he found, he was able to send a message to Tunisia to bring his family to Bavel and purchase them a home and so on. After more years pass, a machlokes came out in Tunisia between the Rav of the city, the same of Yitzchak HaChayik, and the Balabatim of the Shul, concerning the house where the Rav lived. It wasn't clear who had the rights to the house. Did it belong to the Shul? Did it belong to the Rav? And the local Chacham said, we can't decide this. We have to go to the Beis Din HaGadol in Bavel. Bavel was the center of the Mecca for Yidden then, at least in that part of the world. And they said, we have to go to Bavel. So they went to Bavel and they presented their case to the Dayanim. And the Av Beis Din was Rav Naftali Chadida. This boy had now become, over these years, the head of the Beis Din. He listened to the arguments on both sides, gave the psak, and after the psak, he says, I want to thank the Rav of Tunisia. It's in his zechus that I'm sitting on the Beis Din in Bavel because of the filth that landed on his clothing, and I was taught the covet of Torah, so that brought me to Olam Haba and Olam Hazeh as well. He told me the whole story. And then he said to them, what is the machlekes lemaisa, the value that you're arguing about? Who gets the house? How much is the whole thing worth anyway? So they told him the amount, and he paid the amount. He gave the money to the leaders of the community and said, the Rav's house is the Rav's house. Take this money, give it to the Aniyim. And he kept them there for a week and made sudas and simchas and out. So Hamadah said, this is the Mishnah. If you keep the Torah, even when you're poor and impoverished, you might have the Torah, the Ibn Shalom will give you wealth as well. You know, the story, in essence, is a story about Mesirus Nefesh V'Torah. It's Mesirus Nefesh V'Torah, someone who didn't know. He wanted to learn and was willing to leave his family and with nothing. And there are many stories of our Gedolim from Europe with the same story that we could talk about. Just, we have to realize it's not just the European Gedolim, the European Rosh Hashivas, that we have the books that are printed that we know about. There are stories the same in the Sephardic world, their Gedolim, their Tamidei Chachamim, but it's always the same theme. If a person is Maaseh Nefesh V'Torah and ignores the hardships that come, perhaps, it's a trade-off. The people who are willing to live this way generally is a decision they've made that it's worthwhile to them. They'd rather have less and be able to be learning Torah and engage in Torah. And it's a thought. Not everyone can do it. It's not for everyone. But for those who can, this is something they'd much rather do. But again, you could have perhaps switched the names of the cities, switched the places, and you'll have the exact same story in Litva, in Hungary, in Poland, in Russia. You have it in Tunisia, in Bavel, and the same. And again, like we said, the Mishnah is the Mishnah, the Yisoides are the same, no matter where you're going to place the episode. But, sometimes we just overlook the fact that the Sfaradim have their Gedolim, they have their pictures, they put in the Sukkah different than our pictures, and they have their Sfaradim. It's a rich history of Torah that we just very often overlook or are unfamiliar with. But ultimately, the same Yisoides of the Mishnah apply across the board, wherever in the world they may be.